road.
Hey, Doc, we better back up. We don't have enough road to get up to 88.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Welcome again to the Good Trash Genre Cast.
Good Trash Genre Cast.
Good Trash Genre Cast.
This is the story of dreams that came true, and in the process, shattered a childhood, a career, and a family.
My name's Dustin Sells.
But from fame came misfortune.
And he said, please don't leave me. Please don't leave me. And as she turned around to say goodbye to him, he collapsed and passed out on the floor.
I am Arthur Gordon.
Was over the top. His humor crude, often shameless.
The boys teased him a great deal and called him a sissy and bullied him.
I am Dalton Stewart.
He had a short temper. He had a short fuse.
I had to fight a lot growing up.
And don't mess with him.
Unless you were the opposite sex.
He really learned a lot about girls and how to relate to them. And frankly, he became a ladies' man at a very young age.
Everybody, and welcome again to the Good Trash Genre Cast. My name is Dalton Stewart. We're so happy to have you back with us. Dustin is incapacitated at the moment. I think he might
have... alcohol of laughter.
I think he might have had an asthma attack you last summer. You doing all right there, buddy?
I'm doing good, and I'm so glad to be with you guys and the dear listener to talk about documentary film this month. Not our regular show of narrative films you'll never see in a film study class. Rather, we're going to work some documentaries that you may or may not see, but they're not exactly heady fare, and they're definitely not highbrow fare.
They're not considered on the list of "This is a documentary you must see." Although you might hear your friend talking about it over a couple of beers.
Yeah, and they would probably say you
must
see it.
Which is where I first heard about Cropsey.
And that is what we're going to be talking about this month. Let's do some introductions. You've already mentioned your name, sir. Can you just tell us again who you are and a little bit about yourself?
My name is Dalton Stewart, and it is true. I had to fight a lot growing up. Unless you're of the opposite sex.
It's a true statement. To my right, sir, could you introduce yourself as well?
I heard from a friend of mine whose cousin's uncle's sister's brothers told me that I am Arthur Gordon.
It's probably true. He's also the source of all the laughter on the Good Trash Genre Cast. Across the table, sir, please.
I just got back from an island with time travel and polar bears and all sorts of shit, and I rediscovered myself. And you know who I am?
I'm Batman.
As played by Caleb Masters.
That's fantastic.
So many references.
It's like all in one place.
And who are you, good sir?
My name is Dustin Sells, and I may or may not have once had a hook for a hand. And we're going to move...
You're old enough to be in that story.
Right along. And we're going to talk...
Fun fact, he's the only person sitting at this table that was alive when some of the stuff that is mentioned in Cropsey took place.
This is
congratulations,
also
true. Sir.
You know what? I've revolved around the sun more
so
than
maybe,
you.
Maybe our Zodiac suspect moved to the East Coast. And,
ooh, and went to killing kids. Good time. Good people. Fair. You know, killing kids is not a punchline, man.
No.
You are a monster. You are absolutely a monster.
Sorry, Squirt. Some monsters just aren't cut out for the big leagues.
You know, I thought this was going to be our second Satisode. Loyal listeners will recall the other Satisode was our discussion of compliance. And I thought, surely a documentary about child murder will be... Nope, apparently not. Apparently this is going to be the hardest we've ever laughed.
If you're a monster called Arthur Gordon. Moving right along, dear listener, we're going to have to move toward a synopsis of the film Cropsey. And we're going to give you an idea of what's going on. This is an analysis show, not a review show. We will have a short review segment. If you are really wanting to see what the film has and find out all its secrets that way, that's fine. You may pause the podcast and come back. Elsewise, go ahead and remain with us. But I do warn you, there'll be spoilers ahoy. We have a synopsis from the voice of the cinema himself, Mr. Arthur Gordon, if you would, sir.
Realizing the urban legend of their youth has actually come true,
Two filmmakers delve into the mystery surrounding five missing children and the real-life boogeyman linked to their disappearances.
Thank you for that. It's a mystery story. It's also a story about stories in which there are some campfire tales that people tell in their region. There is this interesting intermixing and intermingling of those stories with the true-life horrific facts that at times preceded and sometimes succeeded the actual telling of the story. So,
did you follow that?
Good.
Before and after is what I'm trying to say. So we're going to begin just quick thumbs up, thumbs down reviews. Does this documentary work? And again, we want to say this. We learn more from bad things than from good things, or we learn as much. And you don't necessarily have to love a movie to learn a lot from it. I begin across the table, Mr. Caleb Masters, if you would, sir.
Okay, this is a really tough one. For me personally, thumbs down.
Okay.
However, as a movie critic, I could definitely find a lot of people to recommend this movie to. This is not one I would ever watch again.
Did you find it scary in the watching? Just curiously.
I was unnerved, yeah. So scary in that sense, yeah. But it, it's horrifying, but not necessarily, it's going to sound really bad, I've seen worse. Terrible, right? But, I mean, we live in a world where we're oversaturated with the media and horror stories.
So you're a monster, too.
And being an English major, having to read all sorts of... and working in news broadcast to some degree, yeah. There's a lot of crap.
Horror. Horror.
Yeah, you're kind of numb to it. So, I mean, while this was horrifying...
So you are a monster.
And I am a monster. No heart. And I did find this unnerving... what I find more interesting about the movie is not necessarily the story itself as much as how we're interpreting and filtering the story as a society. So, but as a film critic, this is a thumbs up, particularly to certain people. Personally, thumbs down.
Gotcha. Okay, that's a fair analysis. I appreciate that. I begin also to my left, Mr. Dalton Stewart, if you would, sir.
You know, I really got a kick out of Cropsey. Not in a good way. I mean, I really enjoyed it.
Did you go kill some children after this movie? Dalton?
Dalton bought a van.
We're all trying.
He's also got a mustache going on. It's really nice.
And those glasses. When did you... I didn't get a new prescription here.
This episode is going to consist a lot of us accusing each other of being monsters, I can tell.
He's wearing
a
mustache.
I really like this. I did find this movie horrifyingly unsettling. I didn't find it particularly scary, I guess. Which it's been pitched to me as the scariest documentary ever.
No.
It's really unsettling.
It's not quite that, I would say.
Well, you know how last week we were talking about the best horror is unsettling?
Mm-hmm.
It's horrifying in that sense. It's not actually, I'm losing sleep over... being terrified of something.
Cropsy getting you?
Yes.
Right. Yeah, it's really unsettling. And what I liked about it was what Caleb said is the most interesting part to him. And that was, for me, it carried the entire film, and I thought it was very effective, was this idea of the stories we tell each other as children and how our perception changes as we become adults. It's like I believe it came up on our Treasure Planet episode, or maybe our Into the Wild episode, this idea of, you know, when you first realize your parents are people, and it totally changes your worldview. And I think there is a little bit of this going on in Cropsey's. When you realize the horrors of childhood are very, very real. The monster under the bed is, in fact, a real person. And that's what I really enjoyed about Cropsey, was this examination of childhood bleeding into adulthood. And kind of how your perception shifts the older you get, and you look back and you realize things about your childhood that didn't quite make sense when you experienced them. And that was something I really enjoyed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Dalton Stewart. I appreciate that. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what do you think? Thumbs up, thumbs down. Does it work or does it not work?
I'm going to kind of echo Caleb here. It's just really meh for me. I kind of agree. I see a lot of what it's doing right, but it just doesn't work for me. I think... there's this kind of this thing of I heard a lot of maybe really good things, kind of overrating it, maybe praising it a little prematurely. And so
expectations were kind of raised, yeah. Perhaps.
It's certainly a film whose reputation precedes
it. Yeah. And there's also something, I think maybe I got something that I wasn't expecting. A lot of the sociological stuff that going into the cultural kind of those things. And so I think I was kind of expecting more something like a Dateline, you know, one of those 48-hour murder mystery kind of investigative journalism type things. More so than what we get here.
It's definitely a lot more guerrilla than I was expecting.
What?
It's definitely a lot more guerrilla style, you know?
Guerrilla, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Orangutan. But
Sasquatch style, I believe.
That's my personal style. But on the whole, yeah, I don't really go with it, so.
Fair enough.
It's not my cup of tea.
Okay, that's fair. I watched this before Eddie Praise. It was recommended to me by the Flicks of Nets.
Had you seen this before?
I had seen it before this week.
Okay.
And so upon my first watch, I really was affected by it because I was expecting, I guess, maybe something Dateline-y. Just kind of a true crime. And this is in my wheelhouse. I mean, I love me some true crime.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by that sort of thing. And so I really enjoyed that. It also is about stories and how stories shape reality.
Which is why we're talking about it on this show.
Right. And so that was really interesting to me. And so I was really, really blown away. Upon rewatch, it's not as effective, probably because I know what's happening, probably because I know the bits of the story that are, you know, going to take place and how they're going about it. But it still is a very unsettling thing in that the events themselves are very tragic. And again, I was really resonant with this idea of these stories that we tell ourselves perhaps are somehow true.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it's still a very good documentary. Is it the best documentary, the scariest documentary, anything like that? I wouldn't say that. Mm-hmm. But I definitely have more positive than negative views toward it. I do say this, upon second viewing, the budget really shows.
Oh, yeah. This felt to me like something made in the 90s. This just felt like a very early 90s kind of student film type project.
That's actually something I really got a kick out of was the lo-fi aesthetic.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I definitely noticed it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was very effective in the film because it lent it that this is all about things that happened in the late 70s and early 80s, but also, for some reason, I found that guerrilla style of filmmaking very effective for this story. I don't know what it was, but for me, it really rang true. I think this film doesn't feel as honest if it's glossy.
I think what was problematic with that is that I agree, if they kind of found a way to maintain it, if they'd done something like Room 237 and had their talking heads off screen, but their talking head interviews are shot in HD.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
And that
I noticed that.
That was weird to me.
I didn't even pick up on that. Yeah.
And that's on the second view.
I would imagine, if I had to guess, that's probably because all the things that weren't talking heads were shot without permit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They had cheaper
cameras and all that stuff,
They couldn't afford to be spotted.
Yeah.
They were more noticeable if they were using the high-quality cameras. Although there's all those prosumer cameras, so I don't know. I don't know what the reason for that is.
So I guess I'm complaining about the HD, which is probably a weird thing to complain, but I really do like
it. Well, it's inconsistent with the fact that we see all this really low-quality, older style. It's two aesthetics that are getting meshed together at times. Mm-hmm.
I will note that one thing that bothered me, I wanted to go ahead and mostly give praise my initial just because Caleb, you and Arthur were kind of lukewarm on it. Something that bothered me that serves a purpose but still bothers me is the end. It gets a little wacky in this third act discussion of who is Andre
Rand.
Rand, thank you. I forgot his last name. Who is Andre Rand? Yeah. What is Andre about?
Well, his guilt and innocence began to be this strange question and what people...
And it serves a purpose.
It does serve a purpose. It just seems like a very odd detour.
It takes too long to get to the point. It goes down all these rabbit holes about who he is, his motive, his possible motive, but it serves a purpose of how society, and this bleeds into my analysis, deals with things it doesn't want to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And it serves a purpose, it just takes too long to get there. And for me, that was what I respond to most negatively, was that third act takes a little bit to find traction.
That's fair.
Do you have anything else to say, Dustin?
No, I think that's good, and thank you everyone for those bits of review. Let's move into our analysis section. Again, spoilers ahoy, we're going to talk about who the killer is. I think we've mentioned his name, but we're going to talk about how that's revealed. And so some of the fun of the documentary is, like in a mystery movie, is this discovery of persons and their guilt and whatnot and what happened to them. So here's your pausing place if you're not going to stick with us for analysis, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for coming back, and we're going to continue now with some analysis. I begin with Mr. Caleb Masters, if you would, sir.
Okay, so the thing I noticed while watching this movie is I was having a hard time drawing some analysis, but the thing that kept coming back to me has more... is what this movie is about. Not specifically, but it's about the idea of urban myths. Where do they come from? How do they evolve? Where do they come from? So the lens I kind of started to think this movie through today as I thought about it today was the concept of simulacrum and simulation. It's this idea of this another postmodern theorist, Jean Bouguiard. This is kind of his idea. So to piggyback off Dustin's last week,
some
leotard, we got some Baudrillard. So for you fans
rhymes
out there.
Rhymes are fun.
Mm-hmm. It's fun too, right? Art club.
And so this idea of a simulacrum simulation is that basically there's this idea that is never tangible. It is it's this idea, something that exists in our imagination. It exists, but not tangibly.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window, or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
And so Urban Myst, this guy, the serial killer, who murdered children, which is horrifying, became larger than life. And kids told their friends about it, parents told their kids told their friends told their cousins, you know. So it evolves in this big Urban Myst, and of course, as we all know, when we play telephone, things like that, the myth gets bigger and crazier with each retelling. Yeah. And what's interesting, I find interesting, is particularly in American society, as we've moved into the digital era, these ideas and symbols become a lot bigger. So this movie, what I find interesting about it is the way that we interpret. We forget who the real man is. We forget the real horrors, and we focus on the myth. And for whatever reason, when it's a myth, it's a lot less scary.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still scary, like in the, oh my gosh, this guy could pop up anywhere. He's Michael Myers. He's Jason. That's scary. But it's not the same as this guy went in, kidnapped kids, and killed them.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. I mean, like we say it's real horrifying. That's true. So I'm kind of saying that I think this movie is not directly examining this question, but looking at how, as a society, we cope with real horrors by telling stories about them in a way that is more imaginary. We can't deal with reality, so we imagine a reality that we tell other people about.
And I think the film touches on that. I guess it just kind of takes a little bit to get there.
Yeah, it does. So that's fair. Yeah.
All right, well, Mr. Dalton Stewart, what analysis bring you, sir?
I actually have a couple of things I want to touch on before I get into my main points. I noticed something in this, and this is the, people say life imitates art a lot. Art imitates life, and I find that to happen more frequently. And I noticed it when they showed parts of the Geraldo Rivera expose. It is shot, the sequence in American Horror Story Season 2 Asylum, towards the end of that season, is shot exactly like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's a mistake, because anyone who watches American Horror Story knows that it's basically that week's episode is whatever Ryan Murphy happened to see something about or read something about and threw it at the wall and decided to see if it would stick. I just thought that was interesting. Mm-hmm. Some things we've talked about on the show before, societal upheaval and how people deal with it. That's something that Caleb touched on a bit, and I talked a little bit in my review. How we process a breakdown in the social contract and the social fabric when things start to pull apart and we're seeing things that we're not supposed to see. But we've talked about on the show before. Also, we saw a little bit of the Satanic Panic.
Satanic Panic was back.
Making a comeback. Last talked about at length when we discussed the House of the Devil, the Ty West film.
To interject, the Satanic Panic was this idea in the 80s that there were devil worshippers and they were killing people. Turns out, yeah, there might be devil worshippers, but nobody died.
And to further expound upon it, not only did they exist, it was a large, sweeping government conspiracy.
And to hide them.
To hide them, because people in power were in on it, and smart people were into this and, like, believed it. And there were stories on the news about how it was actually happening. And documentaries abound about the Satanic Panic itself, and it's endlessly fascinating. It is probably one of the biggest mass hysterias since the Salem witch trials.
What Satanism happened in the 1980s was a couple long-haired high school kids who really liked Dungeons and Dragons and heavy metal music, especially Slayer. Just gotta give a shout-out when I can give a shout-out.
Rain blood, bruh.
Rain blood. And that being said, they were into those sort of things. There might have been some form of worship of said deity, but it was not in any way organized, nor were they murdering people in a conspiratorial kind of way, although there may be individual Satanists.
Yes.
Killed people. Sean Sellers in our own state of Oklahoma would be an example thereof.
And most of those people were mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
But the Satanic Panic was a very interesting thing that happened, and if you want to learn more about that, I talked a lot about it on our episode over the House of the Devil. But what I really want to talk about is, it's interesting to me, last week I was able to talk about the sociology of art, this week I'm able to talk about historical sociology, which is where you examine historical documents and try to look at a society and the way it used to be. So sociology typically deals in the present, the here and now, when we examine social trends as they're happening. We look at demographics and what people are doing now. Historical sociology looks at yesterday and tries to piece together what that society looked like based on historical documents. And there's certainly a fair amount of that going on here in Cropsey, which kind of ties back into the Satanic Panic. All of the crimes that Andre Rand is alleged to have committed, and has been two of which he was convicted of committing,
right,
by a jury of his peers, tie into this perception of the 80s. And you hear some people still talking about the Satanic Panic today in 2007 or 8, whenever it was that the filmmakers made this film, talking about these things, the Satanic Panic, which have been widely, we've all decided that was a dumb thing that we let people believe.
Except we haven't.
Exactly. You hear detectives, like people who are responsible for our safety and figuring out our crimes, talking about this like it was a real thing. Listen to what I'm saying to you, listener. People actually believe it's maddening that yes, Dustin, did you want to say something?
I just have a question.
Yes.
Is the reason for that, is part of the reason for that, this desire to other this sort of heinous event,
and I
to
think,
create some sort of boogeyman?
I think that is, that's part of the large issue with the Satanic Panic, and it kind of feeds back into why it's still, we still hear about it sometimes, despite the fact it's been widely, discredited as an actual thing by, our preeminent thinkers. It's really hard to deal with the fact that there are people in our society that like to kill children.
Well, not just children in this case. I mean, they find mentally
handicapped
children.
Children
and prey upon them specifically for some sort of cleansing in a genetic sense, sort of.
Well,
way.
Even that is easier. Even to feed it into some sort of eugenics.
Yeah.
To feed it into some sort of, to make it about something other than someone having murderous impulses, and as with all predators prey upon the weak.
And just finding easy targets, right?
Easy targets. It's easier to believe it's all part of, some large societal ill. It's easier to make it about something else. It's easier to say, there is one thing that is objectively bad, and all facets of it are inhuman and evil, and we can destroy it. Instead of to deal with the real issue that says we have something in our society that is not fixing people, or at the very least, reaching out to people who have these impulses and want to do this thing, and we just kind of toss them aside and try to get rid of them. And unfortunately, as is dealt with in Cropsey, when you try to toss away, the things that society doesn't want to look at, unfortunately, it'll come back and bite you in the ass sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of, again, that's where this sociological history, the historical sociology thing comes into play. Is you look back at a time period and you see that people's reactions are colored by that time period and what was in the popular discourse at that time. That leads me to the last thing I wanted to touch on was is perception and spin, which again is kind of part of the Satanic Panic.
Sure.
This desire to make to perceive things in a certain way. One of the very few people that had a personal relationship with Andre Rand is interviewed in the film. And he's one of the few people that doesn't seem like a total lunatic in this film. He just seems like a pretty level-headed guy, weirdly. Mm-hmm. And he points out, look at this photograph. If I tell you this man is a murderer and a monster, you say, oh, yeah, I can see that. If I tell you this man saved a bunch of children, you say, oh, yeah, I see that. He looks like a good person. Because we want to think we know more about what's going on than we ever do. And that's a problem that is systemic for all of us.
There's a famous experiment in Soviet montage cinema where they took still shots of an actor with a utterly blank face, and then they subjugated that face and they juxtaposed it against other images, and that face worked perfectly for happy, sad, mournful, thoughtful. And I think there's something to that.
I can't remember the names of people involved. There have been a couple of different sociological and social psychological experiments that have taken place that have dealt with this idea of informing your participant of something about a person before the fact, and then seeing how that changes their perception, changes their opinion of someone. also the last thing you hear about someone versus the first thing you hear about someone, primacy, and I forget some of the terms here. It's not my the focus of any of my study. It's, you know, not something I'm. It's not the focus of my study. It's not something I'm, you know, particularly knowledgeable about. I know a little bit here and there. But primacy basically being the first thing you hear about someone, the thing that's going to stick. And there's another principle that says the most extreme thing you hear about someone is the thing that's going to stick. So they play
extremity.
Is it primacy and extremity? Yeah,
I think so.
I think that's it. But again, this is social psychology, which has some bleed over into my field, but it's not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to talk out of school. I don't, you know.
We do it all the time. It's fine.
Fair enough. My point is, though, is this is about spin. This is about what the media does, and journalism is the funnest type of writing. I really love it. It's just hilarious. Monster rain today. Will the madman stand trial? Just, you know, just really.
Yeah. It's all about spin. Headline.
It's all about spin. And that's, again, to me, the person who is.
Yeah, yellow journalism did not die with Citizen Kane.
No.
And it's funny to me, is the person that's friends with the quote crazy guy is probably one of the most level headed people they interview.
It's true. Yeah.
It's true.
So it's basically him and these two older detectives. Andre Rand's. The crazy guy's friend, and these two, the older, larger detectives, the ones mm-hmm. that kind of seem, mm-hmm. I don't know if they were the primaries on the case, but you see them in a lot of the archival footage, more than the other detectives they interviewed.
On the Jennifer case specifically, I think.
The Jennifer case specifically, yes. The two detectives that are always interviewed as a pair.
Yes.
They seem like the three most level-headed people that had anything to do with any of these cases. There are some people that seem straight out wackadoodle in this film. That they interview. And again,
and most of them are religious. I'm just saying.
Well, that happens sometimes. In the death of a child, you know, particularly the murder of a child, is a hard thing for people to deal with. And I think it does take a certain mental and emotional fortitude to come out the other side, regardless if it's your child, to come out the other side of that, you know, and still retain some semblance of normalcy. But again, it's the wacky, crazy, quote unquote, crazy guy's friend. That is the most level-headed about this. That mm-hmm. says, if I told you that Andre Rand ran into a burning building and saved a bunch of people, you'd think, oh, he looks like a great guy. And that is a blank face. That face carries with it whatever you put onto it.
So we're equating Andre Rand to Buster Keaton is what we're doing.
Yeah, sure, why not?
Okay.
My point is, at the end of the day...
Got to keep it movie.
Yeah, I saw what you did there. My point is, at the end of the day, it's all about... It'll say whatever you want it to say.
No, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. Thank you for that analysis, Mr. Dalton Stewart. That was brilliant. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what bring you, sir?
First, I just want to hit real quick. I really enjoy how Parks and Rec deals with the Satanic Panic in their show.
Okay.
Because there's a period where Pawnee is ran by a cult. And so you still see members of the cult every once in a while.
That's right.
And they kind of just poke fun at that group of people who kind of live that life. But as far as crops is concerned, I kind of want to talk about urban legends. Urban legends is something I've always been interested in, mm-hmm. ever since childhood, and folklore, and American folklore specifically, I guess. I just love those stories, and my dad listened to a lot of bluegrass, so those things were there. There are a lot of bluegrass songs about different old folklore stories about, you know, killing a girl down by the tree, or, you know, the ghost at the corner, and picking her up and taking her home, those types of stories. And so those things were always there for me. And so I like that aspect of Cropsey, that exploration of the urban legend and the societal and that the locale part of it. How urban legends are each kind of specific to their...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Where they originate from. And I've always enjoyed that kind of stuff. And
the Deep South has much different urban legends than the Rust Belt.
Yeah. And so, you know, the urban legend really kind of serves as our modern myth, our modern Aesop's fable, if you will. And even with this one here, the Cropsey tale, it serves as a story, you know, don't let your kids go wandering off, and kids stay in groups and stay close to, you know, like, don't go wandering off because of something.
And don't do things teenagers want to do in places teenagers like to do them.
Don't go into the abandoned hospital in the park.
Guys, hold on. Pause. As a teenager, did any of you ever have the desire to go climb in an abandoned building?
Yes.
All the time.
Yeah.
I didn't have any around.
Okay, okay. That was part of it for me.
I grew up in a town that was dying, so those things are everywhere. So, yes.
Okay.
There was a house. We visited it.
I mean, there was a... I lived in the country and, like, down this dirt road, and there's this one of those old rural schools right by my house that had been abandoned for probably 60 years or so. So it's kind of a cool sight, and we walked down there. Me and my parents walked down there one day and looked around, but I never had this temptation to go down there at night to see what happened.
Maybe it's because I was a square, but man, when I was little, I just had no urge to do that kind of thing.
You know, maybe because you grew up in a city and we were country.
You know, Dalton.
And there's nothing else for us
to
do.
Hey, listen, no, seriously, growing up country towns, you have to invent things to do. Seriously.
Fair enough. I was perfectly content to play Halo.
Regardless. So what I want to just hit on real quick, I really like this idea. You know, cinema has become the modern societal peer by which the oral history of the urban legend still lives. It's something that literature doesn't really do anymore. Literature catalogs urban legend. And music catalogs urban legend, specifically, you know, country and bluegrass, that type of stuff. And rock, I'd imagine, to some extent.
Yeah.
But there's no new urban legend that can arise out of those things. There may be in the making of, you know, in the making of a song, there may be a new urban legend that comes, or in the making of a movie like Wizard of Oz, for example, the urban legend that in the scene where the trees are throwing the apples, there's somebody who's committed suicide in the background. And there's this urban legend that if you look close in the background, you'll see somebody swinging back there and they've killed themselves. And we kind of laugh at some of these things, you know, the urban legend. I was just reading that I think a lawyer fell prey to the African prince, what is he, the Nigerian prince?
It's always Nigerian.
It's Nigerian.
The Nigerian prince scam that's been around for like 2 decades now.
This is the history of the internet, pretty much.
Like, that was the first practical joke on the internet. And somebody just fell to it. I mean, a lawyer, no less. And so to me, I mean, those things are still
guys, clear. When in doubt, Google out.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Snopes is a strong reference point when people, like, start blowing up my Facebook feed with all this crap.
Oh, these...
Do you remember when there was a big quote, Morgan Freeman, that literally blew up my Facebook page, and then, like, about a week later, he didn't actually say it.
Yeah. I really always go back to this quote, Men in Black, that really strikes me more now that I've dealt a lot with customer service and retail and food service.
My condolences.
When he says, you know, Will Smith asks, why can't the people know? And he says, a person is smart, but people are stupid.
Yeah.
And people on the whole are stupid. Yeah. And Facebook and social media show that.
So, like, intelligence of people drops in massive groups.
Mob mentality, man.
Yeah.
And that's one example of how the cinema has become this modern purveyor of the urban legend.
Urban legends to our cultural lexicon.
And the other one, the main other one that I want to talk about is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Which
in itself, because in 15, 20 years, kids will still be going. I remember in high school, people were like, oh, have you ever seen the movie about
the true
event? Yeah, and everyone thinks it happened. I believed it until, no joke, till college. I seriously was like,
The voiceover, you know, and the use of the word invalid brother.
Yeah.
You just thought, this has got to be real.
The film which you are about to see is an account of the tragedy which befell a group of 5 youths, in particular, Sally Hardesty and her invalid brother, Franklin. It is all the more tragic in that they were young. But had they lived very, very long lives, they could not have expected, nor would they have wished to see as much of the mad and macabre as they were to see that day. For them, an idyllic summer afternoon drive became a nightmare. The events of that day were to lead to the discovery of one of the most bizarre crimes in the annals of American history, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
And you would think, Caleb is from the Midwest, but Dustin and Arthur and myself, we're all from this area roughly, are from, in Oklahoma, is kind of, those of you, I don't know how many of our listeners.
This means Oklahoma.
This means Oklahoma. I don't know
how many. Mid.
The mid, exactly. I don't know how many of our listeners are from out of Oklahoma. Oklahoma culturally has a weird kind of Southwest Midwest crossover.
Hey, you know, it'd be a fun Twitter game, dear listener.
What?
Give us a tweet with just your location. Give us a state.
Just state. Just go. Just
city.
Give me the state
address. I promise, I won't stalk you.
Don't send us your name, face.
State, nation, or city.
My point is, you would think, being in Oklahoma with its close proximity to Texas, you would find people. You would find more people who would say, "God, that's so stupid that people in Vermont actually believe." No. You would meet people who say quite the opposite, as was discussed on that Urban Legends episode.
Yep,
you got it just right, Tobe Hooper, because my uncle did time with Leatherface.
Yeah,
he told me, "Fucking people are stupid."
And the
right.
Tommy Lee Jones is right, as usual.
Yeah.
God, Tommy Lee Jones is a voice of brilliance.
Well, if you want to keep this going, I just quoted something as if it was actual fact off air, and then remembered it was from an episode of Mad Men.
Yeah.
I'm literally 5 seconds ago, listener. We took a break, and we had a conversation briefly, and I quoted something that said, oh, wait, no, that was Mad Men.
Yeah.
Culture, film and television just continue this cycle.
And then what is
our dialectic of information? Our dialectic of information. Just,
well, and then the fictional becomes reality.
Yeah.
You know, again, since it's the replication, all these things kind of all are analogous.
Art imitates life as life imitates art. Yeah, it's fascinating.
So, yeah.
Dustin, what do you got?
Well, let me describe that synthesis, that dialectical synthesis where we have thesis, antithesis, and we put it all together to create said synthesis, where we have stories and we have reality, and we have reality creating the stories and vice and versa, simulacrum, as you were discussing just a moment ago.
In case you're wondering, that sounds familiar. Why have I heard that before? Because as we discussed a few weeks ago, when the Wachowskis were smoking pot and watching Hard Boiled, they were also reading that book.
They were. And so it's a big deal. All this stuff is tied in this idea that we tend to form a narrative shape in our lives. The way we tell stories is we don't just tell, hey, there was this guy called John, and he really liked apples, and he thought apples would be handy for the colonization of this particular continent, so we planted a lot of them. What we do instead is say, there's this guy, his name's Johnny Appleseed, and he wore a tin pan on his head, and he was kind of crazy, and he did these things, and it becomes this tall tale, and the story itself begins to create greater shape. Now, what happens in the movies, specifically, is that what they do is they take the stories that you've always heard, and they oftentimes say, your story is true. However, there are these few slight alterations to give the sense of greater veracity or truthfulness. Mm-hmm. If you're Stephen Colbert, it'd be truthiness to your story. To say that this thing that you've always believed is correct. It's just you need to just check it a little bit from the folklore. So let's take a vampire lore, for example. So you've got a vampire movie. They're going to say to you at some point during said vampire movie, turns out all the stories you've always heard about vampires, they're real. Except there's this one caveat. Light doesn't affect them. Except there's this other caveat. Crosses, useless. Or if you're watching Friday Night, crosses are only useful if you have the faith behind said relic, for said relic to do what it does.
I mean, think about it, listener. Your brain just went, oh yeah, that's a line in pretty much every vampire movie since about 1980, I'd say.
And really, it's a movie in almost every fantasy slash urban mystery where you have sort of a contemporary setting, fantasy slash horror story, where you say, listen, gang, everything you knew was always true. It's just this doesn't work. Or instead, this works better instead. And they kind of revamp the rules of said story. So we have Cropsey, where you have this story of this kind of hook-wielding madman that everyone tells in Staten Island, because everyone's got some sort of hook-wielding madman, hangman sort of story. And then they say, oh, but here's this thing. There is this real life person who may have killed these children, and they're going to say now that he's Cropsey. Cropsey precedes Andre Rand doing these things, and the Cropsey story follows this in a way. It begins to evolve to incorporate some of these real life events.
Andre Rand's alleged crimes become part of the Cropsey mythology.
Mm-hmm. And it may or may not be true, but we always form a story shape to what we do. Let's just think about the news for just a moment. As we think about different administrations, how they want to create the narrative of these events. That's exactly the terminology that's used. They want to create a narrative that there's this one lone person who's fighting against this particular issue, and they're, you know, submitting this bill, or they're taking this particular military action, so that this evil, whatever it may be, some sort of domestic justice-oriented evil, or it be the state power sort of evil, they form a narrative so that we will all get behind it. Because you can't just tell the facts as the facts are. Because as human beings, what we do when we first organize ourselves as human beings and begin to build fires, we sat around those fires, and you know what we did? We told stories. It was wired into our DNA, into our biology, to do just that, to create these stories. Now I invoke Mr. Lyotard again and his incredulity and skepticism towards meta-narratives. What we do as people, as meta-narrative or narrative-creating people, is that we create all of these stories to kind of give shape and meaning to our lives. And it brings us back to Cropsey, in which these people don't know how to deal with this event that took place. this. And so they invoke a narrative that they already know, and they begin to apply it to the situation, and somehow it provides them some sort of solace. That's what human beings do. Now, if we invoke again Lyotard and say, why do we create narratives, and why do some folks create meta-narratives, is that we live in a world in which there are meta-narratives, plural, where people find stories that are able to shape their lives. The reason why the movies matter, dear listener, the reason why narrative cinema, even though this is a documentary month, and this movie shows so much how this applies, is that narratives, stories themselves, are how we shape our lives.
We're all studio producers, film producers giving studio notes. Well, that's a good story, but what if there was more sex in it?
Mm-hmm. And that's how I'm going to live my life. It would be the next bit of noting that a person might give.
It's just, it's fascinating, though, how much the structure of professional storytelling feeds back into the way we actually live.
And if I were to go ahead and feedback Lyotard into New Begin per last week's episode and say that what we do then is we create these stories. We don't want to create a meta-narrative. We don't want to create an overarching sort of Stalinist narrative that is going to rule all things in our lives.
Real briefly, we actually didn't touch on it that much, surprisingly, in 237. Can you briefly explain to the listener what a meta-narrative is?
A meta-narrative is an all-entailing story that contains all the pieces. And everyone has a meta-narrative.
For example, The Cabin in the Woods is a horror meta-narrative.
Correct. That all the horror stories are all about appeasing this set of gods. Christianity would be an example of another meta-narrative. Marxism would be a third. Perhaps Buddhism would be a fourth. Those things that kind of try to put together all the pieces of human existence. Now, what we find ourselves in the postmodern period is that we have all of these meta-narratives. We have all of these stories and people living out these pieces of different stories. And what a real pluralism would be a meta-narrative, not which we say, that story works for you, so you can go ahead and say Andre Rand is Cropsey. We might say, yeah, you're saying Andre Rand's Cropsey? I call bullshit. That doesn't actually work. And we actually bring all of our meta-narratives into one place, and we begin to have a dialogue about them, and we begin to create different narratives. Will there be a singular unifying narrative based on human conversation? Probably not. But we'll find some that work better than others.
By having a more honest conversation.
Right. By having a more dialogical, dialectical.
By saying, well, no, Cropsey wasn't Andre Rand, and Andre Rand wasn't Cropsey. However,
Cropsey helps us deal with Andre Rand.
Exactly.
Well, we understand how the pieces fit together.
And I think that's valuable.
Yes, certainly.
And I think that's where the conversation comes in. Is it where you mess up is when you say, this thing we've experienced, it's clearly Andre Rand. Or rather, this thing we've experienced with Andre Rand is clearly Cropsey. You might say, we've always told the story Cropsey, and somehow this fits that monster. But we have to make sure that we don't forget the real monster. Allegedly, and deal with those issues in a separate sort of category. And we begin to create these dialectical sorts of narratives. And I think that sort of society in which our stories actually talk to each other, instead of our stories remain isolated from one another, you know, those people who think Star Wars is a religion, they form themselves as Jedi, they're not on a bad track by themselves, but it would do them well to have some conversation with other people besides their mothers.
Well, and that is the postmodern generation, the postmodern theory is deconstruction. The hope is that we're going to post-postmodern and reconstruct, right?
Do something with it.
Which is documentary, I think, does to some degree.
It doesn't do any good to just pull something apart. You got to pull it apart with the intent to have a better understanding of it.
Yep. Absolutely. And your better understanding, of course, you submit it tentatively. You submit it...
Deconstruction for its own sake is somewhat masturbatory in that it serves no purpose, really.
Other than you feel very good for having torn down something someone has spent many, many years, maybe perhaps centuries.
Yeah. It makes you feel great, but at the end of the day, you really just wasted 30 seconds.
And
is
so,
that how long it's supposed to take?
I don't know.
I can pull apart an entire thought.
Joe hooks are fun to make.
So there you go, dear listener. The story about stories is Cropsey. It's lots of fun. I thank my co-hosts for some excellent analysis, some insightful conversation. I'm very glad that we had this conversation about this movie. Because, you know, that's what we turn out and we think about it. It's a big deal. I have one quick question I'm going to ask the table and the round table, and then we're going to move into our game. The question I want to have, and this is a funsy question,
okay,
is the place you grew up, that location, wherever it may be, and we all grew up in different places. Somebody told a story. You heard a story at a camp, at a campfire, at a sleepover, somewhere. And I don't want to hear the whole story, but I'd like to hear at least a name, a citation, and a place of the mythology that may or may have informed the place in which you lived. And we will give time, of course, to construct. I'll begin with Mr. Dalton Stewart to my left, if you would, sir.
I got two right off the bat, and I think Caleb actually brought one of these up recently, either in conversation or maybe even on the podcast. But growing up in South Oklahoma City / Moore, Oklahoma, there were two that I heard about, and that was Crybaby Bridge. Yeah. Everybody's got a Crybaby Bridge.
Everybody.
And the Purple Church.
Purple Church.
Purple Church.
It's big in South Oklahoma City.
That is a big suburban Oklahoma City urban legend, and that is allegedly somewhere on the outskirts of OKC.
Oh, no, it's there. I've been there.
It's not a real thing.
No, it is a real place.
No, it's a real place.
But it's not really what it proposes to
be. Well, of course not.
Which is the site of satanic sacrifice.
Of course not.
Correct.
It is a real place. But in those of you who do not grow up, did not grow up in the Oklahoma City suburbs, a very popular urban legend around these parts is that if you... Because you don't have to go very far in Oklahoma City to find farmland.
No.
That around these rural areas...
In fact, it's less than a mile from Studio D.
It is. It's real close. There be Satanists in these woods. And in fact, there is a physical location to go to. It's not just like you go stumbling around the woods to look for it, like the Staten Island, the tunnels underneath, mm-hmm. which were actually real. There is a place that has been deeply graffitied that urban legend reports.
Where kids mostly drank and smoked pot.
Yeah, and did some spray painting.
That always is, right?
And, yeah, it's funny. We got them. And Crybaby Bridge, I don't really remember the story about. I think somebody crashed. Every town has a Crybaby Bridge. Dustin, do you want to talk about the history of the UCO Film Society real fast?
Oh, just quickly, UCO Film Society, which birthed this particular podcast, we give our thanks to them and whatnot. They hosted a particular film festival hosted by a class out of the Department of Psychology. Now, stay with me, dear listener, but the Department of Psychology did some stuff on pseudoscience and created some pseudoscience pseudo-documentaries.
Yes.
And one of those, and really one of the strongest ones of that particular festival, was the one on the Purple Church.
It was very good.
It's available on the Tube of You.
Yeah.
A.K.A.
YouTube.
And you know what they found out? It's just a concrete slab that's on some farmer's property, which Caleb will tell you.
Hey, crazy farmer.
Yeah, because you've been there, right?
I've been there. Okay, there is a shit. I went there at 2 in the morning, of course. The only time to get there.
You got to go there when it's dark.
Exactly. So there's this giant farm across the street. Okay, first thing. When you're driving there, if you're coming from a certain way, for about a quarter of a mile, there are signs all along the strip that says, you cannot park here. I'm not even making this up. For like a quarter straight, for a quarter mile. And then when you see his house, there's a giant greenhouse with a really eerily bright orange, not yellow, orange light, which lights up and illuminates all the creepy tools he has hanging from his shed.
The guy really enjoys the fact that he has an urban legend on his property.
He really does.
Well, you know, I would too.
He makes a hobby out of chasing away teenagers. I think it'd be a lot of fun.
It would be a lot of fun.
Now, tell us what happens in the great state of Indiana.
Okay, well, you know what? This is actually... Oh, no, this is Indiana. Okay. Sorry. I've lived in a few places. I heard this one while living in Illinois at a camp in Indiana that I went to as a kid. So Princeton, Indiana, there's this camp called, a YMCA camp called Camp Carson. This place has at least 5 urban myths. The one that I remember specifically is this lay in the water lake, which is, and every year I went, there was a different story. But I think the more famous ones, there's a bride, she got married, and then later she saw her husband making out with some other chick, same night as the wedding, so she went and jumped off a bridge into the lake, died.
Isn't that the plot of The Innkeepers?
Kind of.
Close.
Close, yeah.
Not far.
So the rumor is if you go out, and like, of course, when she died, when she jumped in the water or whatever, it was like a quarter... There's something about the moon location.
Frequently, our local folklore myths invoke suicide.
So...
Typically.
So the myth is that if you do it... full moon, half moon, whatever it is, if you go out at the camp, because the wedding was at the camp... if you go out and there's these rings you can swing across in the water thing, if you swung across them and got to the fourth, the last one, the fifth or fifth, whatever it was, the last ring on the end of the thing, she would jump out of the water and grab you and pull you down because that's how she killed her husband.
Ah, I see.
Yeah. So
stay out of the water.
There's
kids.
Also there's stay out of the water, kids. That's one of like eight. That camp had a million of them. There was one about eight. There's two of them about aliens. Yeah, all sorts of stuff.
Nice. Excellent. Thank you for that. Tell us, dear Arthur, where you grew up and where you heard your stories from.
I am from Stillwell, Oklahoma. It's on the about 7 miles from the border of Arkansas, northeast Oklahoma.
You know, there's fun stuff out
south
there.
South of Tulsa. You know, I don't really recall a lot of specific ghost stories or legends, at least.
Because I lived them.
There was one time when I.
Oh, the voice of the cinema began to invoke the story.
Story. Knew it.
Four of my friends and I went to a cabin on a lake one summer. No, but I don't really recall. I will say there was a one of the major aspects of our town. The railroad came through. Well, the railroad came through, kids.
you sound
there's a railway,
as well as
and this
me.
Is a the railway, was
which probably was the death of Stillwell, Oklahoma.
Slightly was a geographic thing for that part of the state in our area. So I remember there being kind of a lot of little ghost stories about, you know, the flashing light on the railroad track. You know,
do you guys have a ghost train?
No, but like maybe the foreman who died on the tracks, and then you see his lantern lighted, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So kind of a standard myth, but it was adapted to a Stillwell story.
Yeah.
Like Crybaby Ridge, for instance.
I would also say, Stillwell is a highly populated Native American town, Cherokee, specifically. So I imagine there were probably a lot of Cherokee folklore as well. Mm-hmm. But I can't really specifically remember any certain story. Like a, there wasn't, I don't remember, like a crybaby, like,
there was no, like, name, there's no poppy name. That's the only reason I remember, again, I forgot the story, I just remember the name.
Yeah.
That was a place where people, I don't think it's even there anymore. I think it actually was torn down.
We did have, there were a lot of rumors about people, though. Like, still was a very gossipy town.
There you go.
There was the, supposed scandalous three-way sex tape of some of the people in the town, like those, those types of things.
Guys, that's way better than the stupid little church.
Dustin, you grew up
Sex
in
Trump's ghost.
Southwest Oklahoma.
I thought you grew up in Arkansas. You grew up all.
You lived in Arkansas.
Well, I once had an occupation that brought me to Arkansas, also to Colorado. I've lived in a few places. I've lived down in Houston, but where I grew up was Southwest Oklahoma, in a place called Carnegie, is where I spent most of that time.
Chilling out,
There we go.
Between Carnegie and a place called Anadarko, where a lot of Native American folklore reads.
Oh, hey, that's where my great grandma lived and died.
Oh, yeah, really?
Yeah,
small Anadarko. World. And so in Carnegie and that part of Caddo County / Kiowa County / Comanche County.
You can tell it's in the middle of nowhere because they all have Indian names.
Or the middle of awesome.
That's the best way to distinguish rural from urban Oklahoma, if you're not a local, is if it sounds like it might be a, you know, an Indian word, it's in the middle of nowhere.
It's out there. Moving on, the Jeremiah's Bridge was a particular story. There was a particular bridge associated with this. Mm-hmm. And there are many, many bridge stories, as we mentioned, Crybaby Bridge.
Did you guys have one?
We have Jeremiah's Bridge, in which a young man called Jeremiah either killed himself, a Native American young man, or was lynched by the KKK, or was somehow otherwise just murdered by other people. And Jeremiah would come, and of course, as the legend evolved, it would always be some sort of story in which lovers would park at the bridge or on the bridge. I don't know what lover would park on a bridge. But and so the hanging body would be seen. So there was always this sort of connection to that. Also, we have famously, I think this is more of a Native American tale all over the place, Deer Lady. And Deer Lady is a thing. In fact, there's a film based on this particular legend available currently on the Flicks of Netflix.
Is it called Deer Lady?
It's one part of the Masters of Horror series.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's currently available on Flicks of Nets. It's called Dear Woman. Mm-hmm. In this case, it was Dear Lady where I grew up.
Who directed it?
The director himself.
The Masters of Horror always have some prestige.
John Landis directed this particular film.
I love John Landis.
Famous horror director.
American Werewolf in London.
Right.
Great one.
In stereo, dear listener. And we're glad to present that to you.
That was fun.
And so I love that story, and that was a story I grew up listening to. I actually haven't seen the film. But I flick through, as you do on the Roku or other streaming platform that you use to access your Netflix. And I said, oh my goodness, I grew up with that story.
Huh.
And so it's on my list of things to see. I wonder how much it's like that. And so I'm going to save my telling of the story because I think that might be a cinematic venue I would want to recommend. And that actually ties into this next thing that I want to do, which is a thing we always do in the show. When we talk about Shelf or Trash, elsewhere instead of, I ask you, Caleb Masters.
Gosh, this is a toughie. This is a streamer. You need a middle. You gotta have a middle. You guys gotta add this middle option. I know, but
we don't have an official one.
Yeah. I'm just saying because this is not one I would ever care to own.
Yeah, well, you want to win.
And as I said earlier, I don't think I'd watch it. But man, if you're into documentaries and you've got Netflix, to watch it. Seriously, it's not even a very long documentary. It's less than an hour and a half. It's like an hour and 20 minutes. Especially if you're into...
It's really worth your time, yeah.
Yeah, it's worth the time.
It's a quick watch, for sure.
Elsewhere instead, I've got to go with... We're going to go with the Hollywood non-documentaries. We're going to look at Scream or Urban Legends. Both kind of get into the meta-narratives that Dustin talked about. Deconstructing urban myths and how they work. Whether particular Urban Legends is good or not is up for debate. However, I think what it does very well is it looks at Urban Legends and says,
"Whoa,
what's up with these?"
You're talking about Urban Legends starring Jared Leto and the Noxzema girl?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a masterpiece.
Also mentioned on the Urban Legends episode of Faculty of Horror.
Correct.
So that's what I got.
The movie's great.
Now I ask you, Mr. Arthur Gordon, Shelf or Trash, elsewhere.
Once again, I'm going to echo Caleb. I say this is definitely not going on my shelf, but I think it's too good to be warranted putting it in the trash. As definitely stream it, or if you're in the documentary, I think definitely check it out. I was kind of hoping there were some issues today. We might have postponed it, and I was hoping to try and watch this with my mom today because I think she would. She really likes documentaries. And so I think it would be interesting to see her take on this. However, I think...
By all means, interject it via the Twitter or the Facebook.
There you go. You don't put it on the shelf. However, you still watch this. Else, you watch it with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You watch it with the Blair Witch Project. See the way cinema is moving Urban Legends. You also need to go out and just pick up some collection of folklore. And read all these interesting little stories that have originated through America in the last... 200, 300 years, whatever. However long we've been a nation, I don't even know.
Mr. Dalton Stewart, shelf or trash, else, or instead?
You know, I'm going to say shelf. I think it's a really interesting bridge between narrative film and documentary filmmaking. I think it exists in a really kind of weird in-between category that I think if only for that interesting formulaic reason, it should be talked about. I'm going to suggest two. One film I haven't actually seen, but it's a film I've heard a lot about that came out this year. It's a film called Stories We Tell. It's a documentary directed by Sarah Pauley about the very thing we've talked about all night.
Where is this available?
I believe in terms of streaming, it's available for rental on iTunes and VOD.
Is it on Amazon, you reckon?
Probably. I don't think it's available in to, you know, some of the lower cost. Mm-hmm. Such as Hulu and Netflix, those, you know, the single deal. I think you kind of pay by the pound places right now.
10-4.
But it's all about Sarah Pauley trying to find out who her real dad is.
Oh.
And because the man who she grew up with as a daddy isn't actually her dad.
I saw that movie.
That's a Pearl Jam song. Right. Moving on.
Definitely maybe.
But there's a whole story in her family about who. It's common knowledge that her dad isn't her real dad, and there's a whole story about who the real dad is, because mom's not in the picture, so it's part of her family's urban legend. And it's a whole film about the stories. It's a whole film about the stories we tell, and hence the title. And it's all about what we've talked about this evening. And it's how we present narratives to one another and shape our understanding of each other. Now, told on a small scale, but the reason that, you know, this small family drama is made more relevant to us is because we do it on a larger scale all the time. I also want to mention, weirdly, a film that's come up a lot lately on this show, but I thought about while watching Cropsey is Prisoners. Mm. Because it is a... Staten Island is, you know, part of New York, but it is got a very much a Rust Belt feel to it.
Sure does.
And Prisoners takes place in Pennsylvania, which is kind of an extension of the Rust Belt. I mean, Pennsylvania Steelers.
Correctamundo, yeah, absolutely.
You know, Pittsburgh Steelers, but Pittsburgh's in Pennsylvania.
Did you say Pennsylvania Steelers?
I did.
I totally missed it.
Yeah. I know where they play. I don't
sports
have to watch
ball. Sports. I don't know.
I actually do know. My mom's a fan. It came to mind. It's got...
It really plays off the thing in Cropsey. There has to be a villain.
Yeah.
And Hugh Jackman won't rest until that villain is brought to justice in some form.
The discussion of the mentally handicapped, mm-hmm. The way in which the mentally handicapped are exploited, the way mm-hmm. in which the death of children is exploited. There's a lot of similar thematic threads here, and not the least of which being an aesthetic one, but in terms of themes and plot. There's a lot of... It was weird. While watching Cropsey, I thought, I really wonder if the filmmakers who made Prisoners had watched Cropsey and kind of got some inspiration from it, because I think there's too many links to ignore. I think it's very interesting how many links there are, actually. So, very interesting pairing. Dustin! What say you, sir?
What I would say is this. I would almost want to ask yet another roundtable question. I will resist the urge. Documentary film itself does not lend itself well to shelves. Documentary does seem as a genre to be a one-off sort of thing.
I think there is certainly a certain amount of diminished returns for documentary.
And so
they don't lend themselves to repeat viewings.
So there is something to that. This particular film, though, I think does reward repeat reviewings in that you begin to think deeper and truer about the concepts being involved in that, especially, I mean, my second viewing, Leotard began to and be invoked, and also New Begin and others, possibly related to Room 237, but really enjoyed that second viewing of the movie. So I would say shelf adjacent, shelf curious, and that's about all I will say.
So you're like the digital shelf,
perhaps. I really do like this movie. I will probably watch it again.
You misheard me. I'm bike furious.
So I will say that about that. What I would say else is Candyman.
Yeah.
Candyman.
We didn't say Candyman, so we're okay.
Candyman.
I see your Candyman.
Candyman.
They say that I have shed innocent blood. What's blood for?
Brian, I know you're listening. I know you grew up next to Cabrini Green, which is a real place, and that this particular urban myth began to affect that urban space, and I find that fascinating.
Now, does the urban legend of Candyman predate the film Candyman?
Yes. No. Excuse me. It succeeds. There is no Candyman urban myth in Cabrini Green until after the film by Clive Barker is made.
And then it does exist.
With a
passion.
And that is my understanding. I am not an expert.
My thesis succeeds.
And so life begins to imitate art.
So, listener, Brad?
Brian.
We got a couple. There's B names. Brian, let us know. You know how you can let us know?
Hey, let's talk about how we can be informed. One of those mediums has something to do with a Fincher film. Can you say anything about that, Mr. Arthur Gordon?
After Morgan Freeman retired from the police department in 7, he went on to form a social media network called Facebook. And he was told by a friend of a friend who worked for his cousin's uncle that social media was going to be the next big thing after Zynga took off. And so Morgan Freeman just all out, just dove right in. So at Facebook.com, you can find this. / good trash genre cast there.
He's using his NPR voice. It's really weird.
You know the very first thing Morgan Freeman posted on his Facebook page? Andy Dufresne was my friend.
Andy Dufresne right away. Guys, you don't have to give me very much like prompting to do a bad impression.
No, you don't.
No.
The outtakes reveal all. However, we do have some feedback in regards to 237. Our good friend Brigham chimes in once again, saying that he attempted to validate the popularity of the Adler typewriter by purchasing one on eBay.
He did.
However, his plan fell through and he failed to seal the deal. But Brigo also asked about...
Instantly, however, the Adler typewriter was available on eBay, proving the thesis stated on the show, which was that the Adler typewriter was the most prevalent typewriter in the early 80s.
No, I took that as eBay being an analogy for the Holocaust.
Did you?
That's interesting, because I've always looked at eBay as an analogy for the genocide of the Native Americans, because it is all about taking things from other people and selling them at a higher profit to others.
You know, if you look on eBay and then you like turn the email address backwards and you type it in,
yeah,
it'll take you to a broken link. I think there's a connection there. I think they don't want you to buy things. I think that's what it's all about.
I always thought eBay was a way to waste time at work. Moving on.
Brigham kind of introduced this idea of doing another commentary / analysis reading episode over The Shining, where we would sit down, watch The Shining, and provide a running commentary reading about presenting our views and ideas. And he seemed actually
interested. You know, we never have any fun doing commentary tracks, do we?
No, it's just nobody else shows up. It's just you and me.
But Brigham actually seemed interested in being there, the way he phrased his thing, that he'd be there interested to do his own kind of analysis.
Oh, that'd be fun.
So we may see Brigham in the future, and that's what Facebook's got us.
You know, I would love to have Brigham Cole or anybody who is local, who can travel to the middle part of Oklahoma to be on the show at any given point.
Hey, I can be the not only reoccurring guest star.
Oh, no. If we got somebody else on, you got to go.
After three more punches, you become a full-time member.
I'm sorry.
The table gets crowded at 5. You got to go. We're gonna have tryouts.
Yeah, auditions.
All right,
yeah.
But listen,
what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna break a pool cue, yeah, and I'm gonna say, "Yeah, 5 minutes.
Fight it out.
Tryouts.
Start working on your traps, bro."
Well, thank you, Mr. Arthur Gordon, for that amazing feedback from the Facey Facebook. There is, as he looks away, which is so characteristic, I sometimes wish this was a visual medium rather than a auditory, oral medium only, where we give you the oral pleasure of listening to our podcast. Mr. Dalton Stewart, let's say you, sir.
On the foggy banks of Lake Stanley Draper, there goes but one media, and it is social. If ye go...
Ye?
Down by the banks of Stanley Draper, you will hear the sound of tweeting. And they say that if you take out your phone, you can tag your location. Ladies and gentlemen... You can find The Good Trash Genre Cast on Twitter at good_trash.
Thank you for that, Mr. Dalton Stewart. We're also available at Gmail. Where's that, Arthur?
You can find us at goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com.
We're also available on Tumblr at goodtrashgenrecast.tumblr.com. Let's do a little bit more feedback before we move on to the end of the show. Dalton, what have you, sir?
Nick Sanford tried to call Bull on the Good Trash Genre Cast and said, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa." Well, actually, quoted us, Good Trash Genre Cast, "We have a strict no Fincher rule. Puts famous track from a Fincher movie soundtrack in intro." And I just had to explain that the Fincher rule applies only to myself, and I've broken it about 4 times in 5 minutes.
You did. I'm sorry. I'm not sure what track he speaks of.
In our intro for Docu-December.
Docu-December.
There's a track from Social Network that in the Hall of Mountain King. It's from the rowing scene in Social Network.
That techno.
That cover of the song is actually from the soundtrack.
Sorry. I failed to make said connection.
Yeah, okay. Well, you can edit this out and make yourself sound smarter.
I will probably do so, because my intelligence is my highest priority.
Well, remember when we said we didn't have a whole lot to say about this movie?
Yeah.
Time to wrap it up, fellas.
Yes. Moving on. dear listener, we are so glad you endured this episode with us all. It was good in bits, and the other parts we hope you suffered through. And we hope now that you would listen and continue to give us feedback and continue the conversation with us, because honestly, we love each other so much. We would have these conversations with or without you, and we want to include you to be parts of it. And so we can do that via the social media already mentioned in this week's show, and also individually. Mr. Caleb Masters, where are you, sir?
I am at Big Cal Kenobi 91 or Masters Film Review, Masters _ Review.
Also, Mr. Dalton Stewart, where are you?
I am located at Beer Corn Dog. No, I am located at Doll _ Stew.
Finally, Mr. Arthur Gordon, where can we find you?
You can find me at RNDTBL Review.
And Mr. Dustin Sells, where can people find you?
Lastly, and certainly least, my name is Dustin Sells. I'm at Dustin _ Sells, Sells, shaken, not stirred. Love to have your feedback on the Twitter, and we're looking forward to next week.
Which, we told you it was going to be Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue when we started this marathon. Then we decided it wasn't going to be because it went off streaming. Then it went back on, but then we liked what we picked anyway better. And it's Arthur's pick as his host pick for the month.
And so next week we're going to deal with a little subject that's kind of near and dear to my heart. I did some undergraduate work in the subject a little bit. And so we're going to be looking at Holocaust film in Hollywood, and we're going to be watching a documentary called Imaginary Witness.
I'm very excited about this. I actually have seen this once, and I'm excited to look at it again. And it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to talk about the Holocaust, because this movie is actually about the Holocaust, unlike The Shining. That's all I have to say.
Smackety, smackety, doo.
So we move from the less enlightening and joyful child murdering into a more popular subject of the Holocaust.
See, if you look at in scene number 5, you look real close, it's actually about the fake Apollo moon landing.
Well, it's, guys, when I was watching Cropsey, it's really funny, because in that opening scene, I couldn't help but be stricken by the trees. The trees behind the mental institution, and I thought about the deforestation that's taken place in the Amazon River Basin.
Dear listeners, thanks for sticking it out. We appreciate you. We'll see you next time.
Voila. Still alive. As I said, class, this story is nothing but an urban legend.
There is a house in New York.